fans, we can all listen to the Sunny Side of Sports.
Great show, bro. This is Sunny Side of Sports.
Right here on the Voice of America.
Voice of America.
Sporty greetings to all our Voice of America listeners. This is VOA's Sonny Young in Washington. Welcome to the January 12th edition of the Sunny Side of Sports. Let's kick off with a Sunny Side of Sports salute for the Crimson Tide of Alabama, which rolled over the Buckeyes of Ohio State Monday night to win the national title in U.S. men's college football. Alabama's dynamic offense was on full display at Hard Rock Stadium in Miami Gardens, Florida, as we hear now from the AP's Josh Roundtree.
Alabama finished an unbeaten season and claimed college football's national championship, beating Ohio State 52-24. Crimson Tide quarterback Mac Jones passed for 464 yards and 5 touchdowns.
I think we're the best team to ever play. I mean, there's no team that will ever play SEC schedule like that again, but at the same time, we're just so happy to have won this game and kind of put the icing on the cake. There was not a lot of pressure. We just wanted to go out there and play the game that we've been playing since we were all 5 years old.
Jones hit Heisman winner Devontae Smith 12 times for 215 yards and 3 scores.
We had a mission. Everybody wanted to end things the right way, and we just all came to work every day and just put in the work, and we got the result that we wanted.
Najee Harris racked up 158 total yards and found the end zone 3 times. Nick Saban wins a record 7th title, as it's the 6th crown for Alabama since 2009.
This team won 11 SEC games. No other team has done that. They won the SEC and went undefeated in the SEC. And then they beat 2 great teams in the playoffs, with no break in between.
Justin Fields passed for 194 yards, but the Buckeyes finished their year at 7-1. I'm Josh Roundtree.
Thanks, Josh. In more American-style football news, New England Patriots coach Bill Belichick says he will not accept the Presidential Medal of Freedom, the highest U.S. civilian award. The AP's Gethin Coolbaugh reports.
New England Patriots coach Bill Belichick will not accept the Presidential Medal of Freedom he was set to receive from President Donald Trump. Belichick said in a statement Monday that he was flattered by the honor, but decided not to move forward with the award in the wake of last week's violent protests at the U.S. Capitol. In 2016, then-candidate Trump read a letter of support from Belichick on the eve of the election at a campaign rally. Trump also appointed Belichick to the President's Council on Sports, Fitness, and Nutrition in December. I'm Gethin Coolbaugh.
Thanks, Gethin. The 68-year-old Belichick was due to receive the Presidential Medal of Freedom on Thursday here in Washington. He is widely considered one of the greatest coaches in National Football League history, having led the Patriots to 6 Super Bowl titles. Belichick also won 2 more Super Bowl championships as an assistant coach with the New York Giants.
Hello, Jonathan Mensah here, Black Stars defender and Columbus Crew captain. You are listening to the Sunny Side of Sports on Voice of America.
In African football, former Senegal international Mbaye Ley is off to a winning start as the new head coach of the Belgian club Standard Liège. Mbaye's team beat Vaslin Beveren Monday night 3-1 in the Belgian Pro League. Moroccan midfielder Salim Amala scored 2 goals for Standard Liège, while Congolese defender Mervel Bokati got the team's 3rd goal. The 38-year-old Mbaye is only the 3rd African to coach a top division club in Europe. For reaction, Iron Mike Mbonye called Johannesburg, where he reached African football analyst Emeka Enyadike.
Oh, well, I must say it's quite a great, you know, piece of news to have him buy, and that's that contract. It's been, you know, some tremendous progress for African coaches. We've seen a few of them getting good contracts in Europe, but for him to get this in Belgium is a welcome development, particularly after we've seen Ndubuisi Egbo winning the league in Albania. And there used to be Sandoli in Holland. So, you know, this means that more and more African football legends and coaches could be up for this kind of contracts. So congratulations to Mbaye for his achievement in Belgium.
Some young Africans like Emmanuel Igbo of Nigeria, Little Vidigal of Angola, and Mehdi Nafti, former Tunisia international, lead the pack of African managers in Europe. Do you think more Africans will top coaching jobs in Europe?
I think African coaches can do well in Europe. One significant factor that often gets overlooked sometimes is that, you know, quite frankly, a lot of them, you know, played at the highest level. I mean, the likes of Drogba, Eto'o and Co. They played with Messi and played with some of the best players in the world. And sometimes people think, you know, they probably can't get the same jobs. But what is important is that they have to go and get their coaching qualifications. If they do their coaching badges, get the UEFA A license or the pro license, and start somewhere. They have to maybe start with the youth structures. And there's lots and lots of them. I mean, just from the Nigerian side, John Otaka is involved with Lens in France, and Shiro Olofinjana is coaching presently in Wolves in the Premier League. And then, of course, recently we saw Quinton Fortune, former South Africa international and former Manchester United player, who was working with the United team. He's currently working with Reading, also in England. So if you get the right coaching qualification and experience, opportunities will open up and you get a chance. So this is where I think African players can emulate the likes of Igbo and Nafi, and of course Mbaye that were mentioned.
What's your advice to young and aspiring African coaches who are interested in European jobs?
Well, my advice to a lot of these young coaches and even the players who are currently playing, before we even talk about coaches, let's advise the African players who are playing in Europe, because some of them finish their career and they come back to Africa expecting to be given coaching jobs when they don't have the qualification. My advice to them is, you know, to take a look around you. You'll find that a lot of the more experienced players in England and elsewhere in Europe, when their careers progress up to a certain point, they start doing the coaching badges quite early. So you need to think about what happens after the career. What that means is that African players who are playing in Europe, and even the ones who are playing in Africa, need to, especially the ones who dream to go into coaching, need to start doing their coaching badges quite early. They also need to look beyond coaching. They have to do, you know, look at programs that they can do even while they're still playing. Look at avenues where they can study sports management, sports administration, and some other, even sports technology and sports analysis. All of those kind of programs that allows them to be able to transition into another role. I mean, the Ghanaian Tony Bafour is currently Deputy Secretary General of CAF. Who knows, tomorrow he becomes the Secretary General of CAF. Kalusha Buala used to be the President of the Zambia Federation. Michel Platini was President of UEFA. So the opportunities are there, but you have to prepare and you have to study if you need to. You have to work your way through the system, understand what you need to do to be able to get in there. Don't just wait until it's too late.
That's African football analyst Emeka Enyadike. And he spoke with Iron Mike Mbonye on the telephone from Johannesburg, South Africa.
Hi, my name is Emeka Enyadike from the City of Gold, Johannesburg. I want to say a big shout out to the Sunny Side of Sports. Thank you.
This is a message in the public interest from VOA Africa.
The World Health Organization and Africa Center for Disease Control say we all can help fight the global pandemic by frequently washing our hands with soap and water or using hand sanitizers. For more information on protecting yourself and others, check with reliable sources such as the WHO and Africa Center for Disease Control. And remember to listen to VOA for the latest on COVID-19.
That was a message in the public interest from VOA Africa.
Hi, this is Larry London, the host of VOA's Border Crossings, where we feature music and interviews along with your favorite artists from around the world. Tune in and interact live with us here in Washington, D.C.
Hello, Shirin.
Hello, Larry. How are you?
Good. How are you tonight?
Border Crossings comes to you Monday through Friday at 1500 UTC GMT.
VOA brings you the best in African music on the African beat. African Beat showcases the latest and the greatest of contemporary African music, from bobo music to hip life, bonga flavor to soukous, Afrobeat to ndombolo and makossa to kwaito. The African Beat on VOA has it all. And it's happening right here, Mondays through Fridays at 09:05 and 20:05 UTC, right after the international news.
Thanks, David. That's David Vandy, the host of the VOA's African Beat music show. Still on the African football beat, the CAF Confederation Cup tie between Nigeria's Rivers United and South Africa's Bloemfontein Celtic has been rescheduled for the weekend of January 22nd to January 24th. The decisive second leg of the last 32 tie will now be played in a neighboring country to Nigeria. Originally, the match was to be played January 6th in the Nigerian city of Port Harcourt. But Bloemfontein Celtic was not able to travel to Nigeria due to the strict COVID-19 regulations of the Nigerian government. Under those regulations, the South African team would have had to quarantine for 7 days upon arrival because South Africa is designated as one of the high-risk coronavirus countries. In a statement, the South African Football Association, SAFA, said, and I quote, "The decision to reschedule the match comes after SAFA reached out to CAF to seek guidance on the matter after Celtic's initial appeal to the Nigerian FA and the Nigerian government was turned down." And the statement continues, "The Nigerian Football Federation is to decide and communicate the venue, date, kickoff time, and the approval of the Neutral Host Association by January 12th, that's today, Tuesday, at the latest." Rivers United leads the tie after a 2-0 victory in the first leg. The overall winner will advance to play another Nigerian club, Enyimba, in the playoffs to qualify for the group stage of the CAF Confederation Cup. In more African football news, 35-year-old Ivorian defender Sol Bamba is being treated for cancer and is currently undergoing chemotherapy. Bamba's English club, Cardiff City, made the announcement. The club says Bamba has been diagnosed with non-Hodgkin lymphoma. The National Health Service in Wales describes the illness as a type of cancer that develops in the lymphatic system, which is part of your immune system. In a statement, Cardiff City said Bamba has begun his cancer battle in typically positive spirits and will continue to be an integral part of the team. Cardiff City says during his treatment, Bamba will support his teammates at matches and younger players within the academy. Sol Bamba helped Cardiff win promotion to the Premier League in 2018. He has made more than 100 appearances for Cardiff City, and he's also made 46 appearances for his national team, the Elephants of Ivory Coast. And we here at the Sunny Side of Sports certainly send Sol Bamba good healing wishes during his cancer treatment. Uruguayan football star Edinson Cavani is set to start for Manchester United against Burnley Tuesday night after a 3-match absence. VOA's Gwen Uten has reaction from Man U's Norwegian manager. Sporty greetings, Gwen.
Sporty greetings, Sonny. Edinson Cavani's return to the pitch comes after he served a 3-match suspension related to an Instagram comment he posted last November. His post included a phrase that was seen as discriminatory, and despite removing the comment and issuing an apology, he was charged for misconduct, along with with a fine of over $130,000, he was forced to miss matchups against Aston Villa, Manchester City, and Watford. Now Cavani is set to start against Burnley. And according to United manager Ole Gunnar Solskjaer, the Uruguayan striker is fit and ready to go. Solskjaer spoke at a virtual press conference on MUTV ahead of Tuesday's match and said in his mind, Cavani's return marks the start of the season.
Edinson's trained well when he's been banned. He's had a couple of days off, of course, as well. You can't train too much, but he's ready to go. He gives us a different option. He's a different type of striker or a forward than Mason and Anthony and Marcus. So I'm glad to have him back. That's why we brought him in. He's contributed really well so far, and I'm sure he'll be really important for us now until the end of the season. We feel the season starts tomorrow night.
And it couldn't come at a better time. United have won 8 and drawn 2 of their last 10 matches.
We won more games, we've scored more goals, we've played better football. So, of course, that's a positive. And but as I said, no one remembers the January league tables. And for us, it's just about developing this team, improving. I think we've shown again that we can bounce back after a disappointment.
And with so many teams jockeying for number one, Solskjaer says he's happy to remain in the top four.
It's important for us now to establish ourselves up among the top four. We've only been top four 3 times since Sir Alex left. So, of course, if we can do that again after third, if we can improve on third, that's progress. And when I played, it was a different ball game. Of course, we were really disappointed if we didn't win the league. And I think we were third once. And most of the time we challenged against one team. Now the league is different. There's so many other teams that can challenge and can look at themselves as candidates to challenge the top teams.
United's match against Burnley will be preceded by a Tuesday matchup between Sheffield United and Newcastle. And Everton returns to Premier League action against Wolverhampton that same day. And that is all from me, Sonny. Back over to you.
Thanks, Gwen. That's my VOA colleague, Gwen Uten.
Squatty greetings, everyone. This is Ambassador Mary Onyale, Olympic medalist, 5-time African champion in the sprint event. You are listening to the Sunny Side of Sports on the Voice of America.
The energetic Andy Edwards spoke recently with Roger Robinson, an author and scholar who has been covering international athletics for more than 50 years. Roger's latest book is titled When Running Made History. In terms of Roger's own running history, he ran for England and later New Zealand at the World Cross Country Championships. In his book, Roger reflects on the 1988 World Championships in Auckland, where Kenya, led by gold medal winner John Ngugi, dominated the cross-country action. In this encore Sunny Side of Sports presentation, let's listen in to Roger Robinson's thoughts on Kenya's performance. Here's Andy.
Roger, in a lifetime of writing about athletics, writing books and journalism, as well as being an academic professor of English literature, you've seen so much. And in your most recent book, When Running Made History, you highlight, among other events you've attended and reported on, the World Cross Country, March 26th in New Zealand, 1988, when Kenya had 8 men in the top 9. And of course, the great John Ngugi, one of his 5 World Cross Country wins, won the individual title. And I'm interested to know, you say that was, for you, a significant point in running history. So tell us more. Why do you think it was so important?
In that book, Andy, I was linking history to my personal experience. And that was an event that I was present at as television commentator. And I had to somehow find words to tell a mainly New Zealand audience what this meant, an audience that was not used to cross-country and certainly not used to international cross-country. And I think what I said was, this would be like the World Cup rugby being rugby final, the final of the World Cup rugby being won by a score of something like 100-0. And it was to see the Kenyans doing something that you normally only see in high school and filling all of those top places, with the exception of that one Ethiopian that got it, I think it was fifth or sixth, and therefore getting so close to the perfect score of only 21 points. If your listeners are not familiar with it, cross-country is a little strange in that you add the points according to the place finished. So the winning team gets the fewest points.
We've seen Africans coming through to the fore, and indeed in your book, you mention, of course, Abebe Bikila, two Olympic medals, gold medals, 1960, 1964, Mama Wolde, those Ethiopians and Kenyans coming through. But in the early 80s, we had Carlos Lopez of Portugal, didn't we, winning the World Cross. But now it seems there was a turn of the wheel in the World Cross country in 1988. With that domination.
That was the day, I think, that the Africans, the East African nations, Kenya and Ethiopia, first became completely dominant. And they've remained dominant ever since. And that chapter in my book considers this phenomenon, and it doesn't attempt to in the usual way to explain why. I mean, I mention altitude and hard training and other factors, but my concern was really to do something that nobody else has ever done, which is to ask, how has this phenomenon affected our sport, the culture of our sport, a global sport? And pointing out that this is just, it's really unique. And I say something like, we all know Brazilians are good at football and Italians are good at singing. But you couldn't say that the best 98% of the best footballers in the world are Brazilian, or 98% of the best singers are Italian, but 90% of the best long distance runners are indeed Kenyan, Ethiopian, and from that right shoulder of Africa. It is quite astonishing. No other global human activity has ever seen this degree of superiority. So I was concerned to say, how did we, if you like, you know, the culture of running, react to it? And my conclusion is, of course, there are always going to be some things going wrong, some exploitation, but overall, the response has been phenomenally good. And the African runners have been welcomed, they've been celebrated, they've been praised, they've been made into heroes, they've been given lots of money, and they've been treated as really role models for Western runners. And you know, I'm a runner. I've been, like you, Andy, I've been doing it all my life. And I love to see people doing something that I love so supremely well. I've never seen people run as well as the Kenyans and the Ethiopians do. And it's a joy to watch and a joy to praise. And for me as a writer, a joy to write about. I think that's the position that we've taken. And it's actually very good. I actually call it in the book, I think it is important, because this is like a reverse of imperialism, because our attitude to Africa is no longer in the running community. It's not, this is a place that we go to exploit. This is not a place that we go to take them our religion or our political system or our anything else. We go to Africa to admire them and to learn from them.
Interesting that you mention Western runners or non-Africans going to training camps, which have now been created in Kenya, Ethiopia, and they've been created, it seems to me, from the various management teams, structures, people like Jos Hermans, the Rosa family have their training camps, among others. They've been created by Western managers. Do you think that is because the Kenyan Athletics Federation or other Kenyans aren't interested in doing it? Why have Western managers had to come in and seemingly create that?
I once talked with Wesley Correa. At a time that he'd been a Boston Marathon champion, and he was at that time, I think it was in New York that we had the conversation, and he was very forthright about this. He was also a member of parliament in Kenya at that time, and he was very forthright about some occasions when the African runners are being exploited and not treated well. And that, I think, is true. I would say that this is a necessary transitional phase, because clearly these people of such supreme talent have got to go into a strange world, the Western world, that they don't know, and they don't know how the financial system of it works and everything else. And they need people to guide them, and hence there are agents and managers. And many of them are doing a really great job. You know, they are kind, they are honest, and they're really providing that necessary transition and education and opportunity for the African runners. There will be some, and I don't want to make accusations on your program, but by name, but there are some where there has been exploitation and there has been an improper use of performance-enhancing drugs. And that's regrettable, but I would like to say, I would like to see that it's just a transitional phase, and that very soon we'll have African agents, African managers, because now there are people who do know the Western world and would be perfectly capable of coming and operating there and doing the deals and doing the negotiating and working with media and all the other things that need doing. And that would be a wonderful step.
Interesting. And again, this is part anecdotal from my experience and also watching, of course, now we can see so much online, it's a veritable flood. But the NN running team, the Jos Hermans company, in effect, have created some, well, I find very interesting videos about the running camp in Kattegat and also documentaries about Kenenisa Bekele and others. And okay, this is the management speaking. So as a journalist, one always approaches things with a wary eye. But I was very interested to see in the documentary on Kattegat camp, there's Patrick Sang, coach to Eliud Kipchoge and many others, saying they're talking about the runners having committees and they vote to decide each year who's going to be on the committee to attend to cooking duties, cleaning duties. And Patrick Sang is saying, look, in many aspects, they're running the camp. It's not, he didn't say this, but it's my words, it's not a Westerner coming in and saying, who's going to chop up the vegetables this lunchtime? That seems also to be an evolution.
I agree. Patrick Sang is somebody I have a great admiration for. He's clearly beloved by his athletes. And so one or two of the top Ethiopian coaches, like Sentiyehu Eshetu. Patrick Sang has been enormously helpful to me, and I'm sure to you as a journalist, in talking about his athletes and giving access to them. And that's a really good development, to have a Kenyan coach coaching Kenyan runners and working with them in a Kenyan culture and not imposing the Western model, which was inevitably what happened to begin with. And admire him and learn from him. I find that a wonderfully refreshing relationship.
I was much taken by a comment by Jos Hermans. It's about a year or so ago, but with the pandemic, it seems like last century. But he was writing, certainly this is before lockdown, before everything, and it was after one of Eliud Kipchoge's world records, great runs. And he said how distinctive and unusual Kipchoge is as a man. And again, if we're drawing on our mutual anecdotal experience, you can interview world record holders, not just in distance running and great champions, but in anything. And you come away thinking, well, that's their skill. They can jump or throw or a long way or run fast. But then you meet some, like I think Paul Tergat.
Hello, sports fans. This is Paul Tergat, marathon champion from Kenya. You are listening to the Sony side of sports on the Voice of America. Voice of
America! Haile Gebrselassie and now Eliud Kipchoge, not only are they great champions and world record holders, but you think they would be distinctive and special people in a completely different field.
Yes, that's absolutely true. And one of the privileges of working as a journalist and being, I suppose, an older journalist, which means that, I mean, I'm now older than any of the runners, of course. But it's been the opportunity to have conversations with people like that. I was sitting there, you may have been there, I don't remember, but in Berlin a couple of years ago, sitting at a table with three or four other journalists and Eliud Kipchoge and talking about Plato and Greek philosophy. to the disconcertment of some of the other journalists. and all credit to him. I'm not able to talk about his culture, and I wish I could. And that would be the next stage, when people are able then to have, people are learning about African culture. I mean, we're learning about African culture so far in the running context, and that will and should go beyond that.
That's athletics author and scholar Roger Robinson. And Roger was talking with the energetic Andy Edwards. wraps up the January 12th edition of the show. Thank you for tuning in. I'm VOA's Sonny Young in Washington, and that's the sunny side of sports.
I get it.